So, good morning, everyone. I'm really happy to be here and to tell you about the galactic disk and bar and action angle space as seen by Gaia-DIA 2. And I want to especially mention also my collaborators that have contributed one way or the other to the research that I'm going to show: Coronado, Fagudi, Hunt, McCarrath, Rick, Selwood, White, and Bovey. I'm pretty sure all of you have seen this beautiful plot that was released on the 25th of April in 2018 as part of the Gaia data release number 2. This shows for stars within 200 parsec around the Sun, the in-plane velocity. So here we have the velocity in the direction towards the galactic center, and here the tangential velocity is in the direction of galactic rotation. And that's the number of stars that we see here. And I think we were all amazed by the amount of substructure that we saw here. I had a similar plot that I wanted to make on the first day of the Gaia data release, but take all stars within for which we had good distance measurements. So this is approximately true for 1.5 kiloparsec around the Sun. They have parallax over error larger than 20, so just 5% distance error. And then I calculated for all these stars the actions, and I'm plotting them here, like the angular momentum and the radial action. And also, in this plane, we see a lot of substructure, like these lines and ridges. I don't know how many of you have actually worked on angle actions, so I want to give a little introduction to make sure that we're all on the same page. So this is a typical disk orbit in an axisymmetric potential. And in the epicycle approximation, we can decompose this orbit basically into two circles. We have the star is going around a little circle, which is called the epicycle. And the center of this is called the guiding center, and the guiding center is going around the galactic center. And the actions are basically related to the size of these two circles. So the size of the epicycle is related to the radial action JR. So if it's zero, then you basically have a perfectly circular orbit, and the larger JR gets, the more extended your reset in the galactic plane is going to be. The guiding center circle is related to the phi action, which is mathematically just the angular momentum. The angle coordinates belong to the actions. They're the canonical conjugates, and they tell you where on the circle the star currently is. And they're defined in such a way that they increase linearly in time with the fundamental frequencies. If we want to calculate actions, we need the 6D phase-based coordinates, so positions and velocities as observed by Gaia. Then we assume a potential, which we assume to be axisymmetric, and we use the Milky Way potential 2014 from Joe Bovey. In addition, we use a fast and efficient estimation algorithm, and we use James Binney's Deckel fudge, and I think it takes like 10 minutes to estimate actions for all the 7 million stars in the Gaia IBS sample, so this is a really good one. And then we end up with a set of estimates for the axisymmetric actions, angles, and frequencies. Now I want to give you some guidelines on how to interpret these actions plots that I'm going to show throughout this talk. So the angular momentum should be thought of as a proxy for the average radius of where the star lives, and the radial action is a measure for the orbit eccentricity. So basically down here, we have stars that are on near-circular orbits within the survey volume that I assume here to be 1.5 kiloparsec around the Sun, and up here we have rare, highly eccentric orbits. The decrease in the two directions is basically a population effect. So we know that the disk star counts decrease with radius. That's why it's decreasing here. And this decrease up here is set by the radial velocity dispersion of the population. The outer envelope is basically a selection effect, and that's important to note. So stars that are here, they're currently close to upper center. So they usually live more inside from the Sun, but they have eccentric orbits. And we only can observe them if they're currently close to upper center, and vice versa, stars here are close to pericenter. Stars in this region that are colored purple, they do exist, but they can't reach into our survey volume, so we won't be able to observe them. So it's just important to note that this envelope is basically a selection effect. Here I'm comparing mock data that I was preparing for during my PhD for axisymmetric modeling with what we got in the Gaia data. And maybe now you can see why I was so surprised about the substructure in the Gaia data. How should we actually deal with all these non-axisymmetries? And that's just some thoughts, what I think what the way forward should be. One of the ultimate goals is to do axisymmetric action-based dynamical modeling of the Milky Way disk, which would provide the gravitational potential, maybe a measurement of the dark matter distribution across on the chemo orbital distribution of stars, which is an important constraint on disk formation. And this axisymmetric action-based model can then also be used as a baseline for perturbation theory to put in spiral arms and bars. However, with the Gaia idea too, we now have to think about the substructure that we see and if it could bias the modeling. So I think we need to do several steps first. So the first step is to understand the properties of the substructure that we see. The second one, look again at the theory and understand signatures of the underlying origins that could cause these signatures, for example, bar and spiral arm resonances. Of course, this has been studied, luckily, also in the past. Resonances have been studied in velocity space and in the space of axisymmetric actions, and also people are working on actually putting up models that use the actions, including the perturbations. The next step, in my opinion, is that we need to do some qualitative labeling of the feature. So really say this feature is caused by the bar, this by a spiral arm, and that's by a flyby alpha satellite. Because only then we can do proper quantitative modeling and use this, these informed guesses and improved models. Right now, I think we're stuck somewhere between step 2 and 3. And what I'm interested in, if there's maybe a simple middle ground that uses axisymmetric actions, angles, and frequencies that can tell us something about the mechanisms that cause these features. So the second part of my talk is about the extended orbit substructure of the galactic disk as seen by Gaia Idea 2. This is again the Gaia data. Here I'm showing the spatial distribution and the velocities. And here I'm overplotting lines that I think show where we see the substructure. And the interesting thing is that the orbit densities appear to lie along linear lines in action space. And they also appear to show up in parallel pairs. At low radial action, they have different slopes. And we observe even one with a positive slope. How is this related to what was already known before Gaia Idea 2, so to the moving groups? So this is the velocity plane. I'm marking the moving groups like Sirius, Hyades, Pleiades, Hercules is now 2 or even 3 different clumps. And here I'm overplotting over the corresponding action plane the location of these stars. And so you can see that the moving groups are basically the clumps at the edges of the action distribution and also related to some of these arches. But as I've mentioned earlier, especially these edges are dominated by selection effects. Here I'm doing it vice versa. I'm picking stars in the ridges and overplot them on velocity space. And now you can see that these ridges are actually the arches in velocity space that have been also mentioned or discovered by the Gaia collaboration and also by Kawata in the V5R plane. Basically, these dots are these arches. But I do think that they can be seen more nicely in action space. And also note that actually the number of stars with positive and negative radial motion is different. So for example, in this green arch, we have more stars moving outward than inward. In the next few plots, I'm going to click through different sub-selections of the Gaia data. And you'll see that in action space, basically, the features don't change their location. Very much. So if you just, so the envelope will change because of the different selections, but not the location of the feature. So this is above the plane, below the plane. Now in the XY plane in different sectors around the sun. This is in a shell around the sun, excluding the solar neighborhood. And this is an even bigger shell. However, the data is slightly worse there, so because of the measurement uncertainties, but the main features can still be seen. And I think the implication of this is that these are not just local perturbations, but actually an extended orbit structure that's being present everywhere within 1.5 kiloparsec from the sun, with the same location and orientation and action space. And what we know as the moving groups are, in my view, the local selection function affected manifestation of this extended orbit structure. One very interesting property of this orbit structure can be seen if we color code the action plane according to the fraction of inward to outward moving stars. We saw earlier that this might be different for the different features. And in fact, like basically the whole plane contains these asymmetries. And this should be seen as a large-scale analog to the asymmetry that we see in the V5 VR plane. And also the interesting thing is that the strongest asymmetries appear to be related to the overdensities that we see. Now part three, what do the axisymmetric actions tell us about the galactic bar? So this is, again, the simple epicycle explanation of a disk orbit. It has two frequencies, the radial frequency of the star around the epicycle and the phi frequency of the star of the guiding center around the galactic center. And if we have a perturbation in the system with a certain pattern speed, we now have three different frequencies. And if they're integer multiples of each other, then we can have resonance effects. Because that means that basically the star meets the bar always when it's at the same phase. So the pull of the bar will accumulate over time and can substantially change the orbits. And this happens when this condition here is satisfied, resonance condition. M tells you something about the symmetry of the system. So for example, for the bar, the M equals 2 Fourier component is very strong, so this will be strong perturbations for the bar. And the L value tells you something about the rotation that we're looking at. So if L is 0, then the star and the bar rotate together. So that's the co-rotation resonance. And for L plus minus 1, we call this the outer and inner Lindblad resonances. I wanted to check what these resonances do to the stars in the space of axisymmetric actions. So this is a simple mock data setup where I created stars from a quasi-isothermal action-based distribution function and an axisymmetric Milky Way potential within a large annulus. And this is how the corresponding action plane looks like, quite smooth. Then I imposed a bar. I'm using a simple quadrupole model, the Denon bar, with a fixed pattern speed that I assume here to be 35 kilometers per second per kiloparsec. And then I integrate the stars and this potential. And this is how the action distribution changes accordingly. So you see that like some regions of action space have actually developed this kind of ridges. I know I can, from the end positions of the orbit integration, I can estimate axisymmetric frequencies and then calculate the lines in action space that satisfy the resonance condition and overplot them here. And you see that, for example, this very strong ridge is actually related to one of the resonances, the outer Lindblad resonance. But these frequencies, the axisymmetric frequencies, they're not the real frequencies of the stars. They're just a current estimate. But luckily, in the simulation, I can calculate the real fundamental frequency of the orbit. This is done by integrating the orbit and then Fourier transforming the time evolution of the spatial coordinates. So from the R evolution, we get the epicycle frequency, and from the phi evolution, the circular frequency. We plot the star in this plane. For these lines, the resonance condition now with the real frequencies is satisfied. And we see that really at the lip-blood resonances and at the co-rotation, stars pile up. So we can use this plot to select the real resonance stars. And this is where the real resonance stars live in action space. And now we see that at the co-rotation, for example, the co-rotation resonance affects the stars in a much wider region than just at the resonance line. But it also tells us that this ridge that we saw to the right-hand side of the OLR resonance line is almost exclusively made up of real resonance stars. I was also looking at the effect on individual orbits that the resonance can have on stars, and nicely, it agrees with what has been found in theory before. That's one of my favorite plots that shows how stars get scattered in the axisymmetric plane, in the plane of axisymmetric action. So basically, what I call scattering, I mean the lasting change to the orbit. And because in a BART system, the Jacobi energy is conserved, this predicts that the radial action and the angular momentum have to change at a fixed ratio, L over M, that's given by the resonance in question. So at the OLR, stars get scattered to the upper right. And that's why we see this high radial action ridge to the right of the OLR resonance line. This is another plot from the literature from last year, which I quite liked. It shows, so James Binet found from perturbing the axisymmetric orbital tori, like actions and angles, with a bar potential, that stars oscillate around the resonance lines. And I found this too in my simulation. And I think this is very interesting because it also means that the behavior is simple enough that we might be able to include this in model and actually fit to the data, also in axisymmetric action space. But what I was also interested in is what happens if we apply now a Gaia-like selection to this, because that's just for all stars in the galaxy. But how to combine this with a selection effect. So here I'm picking stars within a spherical selection that has different orientations with respect to the bar. So the upper one is 25 degrees, so like the sun has to our bar. This is the density of stars in the action plane. And you see that we have ridges, but they are of different strength and dependent on where we look at with respect to the bar. And here I'm color coding again to the asymmetry of inward to outward radial motions. And I think it's very interesting that here at the red line, which is the OLR, we get a red-blue feature, which doesn't appear, for example, if we are aligned with the bar, and which flips when we are on the other side of the bar. And this is quite interesting. I was also looking at different pattern speeds at different time integration times. And this is really a signature that stays at the OLR. So to show you how this would look like in velocity space, this is now the red-blue feature around the axisymmetric OLR line in action space. And here I've plotted the same stars in the velocity plane. And you can see that we get features that might look like a solar neighborhood, maybe or maybe not. And what is the origin of these features? So the blue feature, so the inward moving feature here, is made up mostly of X11 orbits, as Francesca Fagudi found in an N-body simulation. And these X11 orbits are elongated along the bar. And in the solar neighborhood, they're basically always inward moving. The red feature contains a lot of stars at X12 orbits and also other orbits that are elongated in the opposite direction. And if they pass through the solar neighborhood, they will have a positive radial velocity. This has been also mentioned in the literature a bit earlier, or I think it's actually around for several decades. And that's a nice illustration from a Denon paper that shows that at the OLR, orbits flip their direction. And this flipping of the orbit direction can be, is basically what happens here at the resonance line. But in action space, this flipping is really exactly along the axisymmetric frequency line. Back to the Gaia data. We have in the Gaia data a lot of these red-blue features. And so I had the idea, what about we just take one red-blue feature and put the OLR line in between there? What pattern speed would this correspond to? And I think I see two of these red-blue features. One is here. This corresponds in velocity space to the Hercules region. This could be one potential location of the OLR. And the other one I see here, and this corresponds to this velocity feature that has the name hat because it sits on the velocity distribution like a hat. So here, now I put the OLR between the red and the blue feature here. And this corresponds to a pattern speed of 1.85. And I was pretty excited about it because from this simple exercise, I got exactly the same value that Antocha and Denen et al. Found from modeling the local velocity Hercules stream with the bar OLR. Also, the ridges that we see next to the resonance line have similar slopes than the one ridges, the ridges that we see next in the Gaia data. So I think that's quite nice. The other model was the hat model, which puts the OLR between this red and blue feature. What I like about this model is that the largest or most prominent underdensity of stars here would then be explained by the OLR that's also in the model. So this is always the Gaia data, and that's the model, sorry. This corresponds to a pattern speed of 1.2 omega naught. It is slightly lower than what Altwin showed previously in his talk by the 1.3 that was found from looking at the kinematics in the galactic center. But this is this model would also help label two of the strongest ridges that we see with the OLR and the 1.24 resonance, and that was also an idea that was put forward in this paper by Monari last year. So last part of my talk. That's the most recent thing that I've worked on, looking at the axisymmetric angles estimates and checking if they could give a constraint on the bar pattern speed as well. So this is the definition of the angles or the convention. The radial angle tells you how the star goes around its epicycle. And if it's at zero, then it's at its barycenter. Then it's increasing outwards until it's at upper center at plus minus pi. And then if it's negative, it's inward moving until it's back at the pericenter. The tangential angle is the angle of, it's basically an azimuthal angle, but not of the star, but of its guiding center. And it's defined to be zero at the stellar position. This is again my little mock data simulation in the still axisymmetric unperturbed case. This is the XY plane, the action plane, and the angle plane. And as you can see, the distribution in the angle plane is uniform by construction. Also, when I pick stars at the resonance lines that I can just basically overplot, the distribution is uniform. And this is the case because there's no perturbation in it. But it gets interesting if we put the bar in, because now for the resonance stars, they seem to accumulate around linear lines in this plane. And they lie along lines of slope minus m over l, with m and l again telling us something about the resonance in question. And the idea is to use this to decide which resonance we're looking at. Maybe to give a little bit of background why the resonance stars follow these lines. Here I've plotted four example resonant orbits at the four different resonances. And that's the corresponding angles planes. And here at zero is the pericenter. And as you can see, this orbit can have pericenters only in two ranges of azimuthal angles. So that's why we have two bumps here This one has only on one side, so we have it here. This one can have it at four different position, azimuthal position, and the co-rotating orbit just lives on one side of the bar. That's why it's basically just on one side of the bar in the angle plane. But here I'm cheating, of course, because in my simulation I know which are the true resonance stars, but for the Gaia data we don't know that. So I was playing around a bit, trying to pick stars in the action space that could be resonance stars. But actually, I messed it up. This messes up for these two resonances because I don't see them now to follow my overplotted lines anymore. But it works at least for these two resonances. The next thing is that the Gaia data, we don't have it for the whole disk, just in the sphere around the sun. So now I have a sphere around the sun. And this removes basically most of the angle plane. Let's zoom in. There might be still an overdensity of the appropriate slope, but we're not done yet, because also the completeness of the Gaia data is decreasing from the sun outwards. So here I'm taking stars in the outer regions, like I imposed an exponential decrease in completeness. And can any one of you see here a ridge of slope minus two? I can't. But I had the idea that we could maybe make use of the fact that we expect in a phase mix system the same amount of stars moving inwards and outwards. So I flipped this plane both in x and y direction. Then the peak has shifted, but the outer envelope is similar. Then I subtracted, and here I'm showing the relative residuals. And now we have the like a red and green features that are separated by a slope of the appropriate by a line of the appropriate slope. And this is the case when I go again back to the real resonance stars. This works actually for all the resonances, that the red and green features are separated by a line of the appropriate slope. Yeah, thanks. Okay, so now I take the OLR. I vary the pattern speed, so basically I scan with the OLR over action space. I select stars at this potential OLR, and so I get for each pattern speed an angle plane. So the envelope is the selection effect because of the restricted volume. And now I have to pick that plane that looks most like the model prediction. I think it's quite hard. Yeah, I was struggling with this for weeks. So. But today I have the unique opportunity to give a talk on the 1st of April. I mean, how often does that happen? So I made last week at the Gaia Sprint a fun little experiment, and I let people crowdsource basically what they think which panel looks most like the prediction. I shuffled the panels and I hid the pattern speed they correspond to so they don't vote for their favorite pattern speed. And if you want, you can also contribute in that. And that's the result of this little survey. I did this for two different resonances, for the OLR and then independently for the 1-4 resonance. And so I get different votes. And I thought it was quite interesting that several people voted for the 1-4 pattern speed, and not just for one of the resonances, but actually for both resonances. And I've overplotted some measurements from the literature, and there exists like one model that is really would really set the pattern speed to be 1.4. That's the model from Hunt et al. From last year, which predicts that the Hercules could also be caused by a 1-4 resonance. And this is how the actual angle planes would look like for the four different resonances. I mean, it's not perfect, but I think we could pretend this was really at a slope of minus two. And here we have really, here it nicely looks like a slope of minus four. To summarize, the space of axisymmetric actions of Gaia Tier 2 reveals a system of orbit substructure that extends out to 1.5 kiloparsecs from the sun and experience shows a lot of of asymmetric radial motions. The outer Lindblad resonance of the bar is expected to cause such inward-outward moving features. And a simple comparison to the Gaia Tier 2 data proposes two bar models that are interestingly close to the two existing bar models, the fast one and the slow one, even though mine is even a little bit slower. And then the space of axisymmetric angles in Gaia DR2 surprisingly prefers the bar model by Hunt from last year. So I've basically recovered every existing bar model in the literature independently from looking at the action angles. However, there's no consensus yet. But I'm still optimistic that dynamical modeling with axisymmetric actions, angles, and frequencies can and will still be super interesting over Gaia DR2. Thank you.
Thanks, Wilma. Do we have any questions? Same people. So let's try some. Martin over there.
Nice talk. The spiral arms would screw things up a bit, no? The spiral arms would screw things up a bit, no?
Just a bit. Yeah, so I think that Jason Hunt is giving a talk later this week where he, in excruciating detail, is going to show you what spiral arms do. But yeah, but I think because we have like at high radial action, we have seven ridges, we should just pinpoint one down. That would already help. So I thought I'd just start with a bar and let the combination of the different mechanisms to other people.
So it looked like the ridges in the data look are curved, whereas in your models they look like straight lines. So I wonder.
Do
if
you think they look like they're curved?
Look to me like, but anyway, I guess my question is more general, that there seems to be more like higher order things in this data, not just like the curvature, but also it looks like there is different separation between the blue, red and the blue part in different, I guess, ridges you consider. So just wondering what additional information could be obtained from modeling that as well.
It's a good question. So I think the way how to proceed would be, if we knew a feature was caused by the bar, then like Christoph was explaining to me 2 weeks ago that from diffusion theory, you could really predict how thick or how wide or how curved this ridge would be if you know which resonance causes it and how hot the system is. And I think in this case, we could really do a quantitative modeling that also tells us something about the strength of the perturbing feature. But yeah, I think at this point in time, I cannot say anything about this.
Nevins?
So my question was actually somewhat related to what Anna asked, because again, I see these features as being curved. And the fact that you get straight lines is a consequence of the perturbation theory that you're using. You're using a linear perturbation theory in which you're assuming the fast action is exactly conserved, and then there's a variation only in the slow action. If you were to allow the fast action to vary as well, those straight lines would become curved.
Okay, good. Maybe I'll ask you about this in the coffee break again, but thanks for pointing that out.
Anyone else?
Yeah, this is just great. I've been following your papers. Very interesting. I would have always, a question I asked in grad school, and I've never had an answer since, is what fraction of stars get trapped in resonances, and what determines the timescales, and so on and so forth. I would love it to believe that we're going to get to a point of forensics where we can actually run n-body simulations and actually see what fraction of stars are trapped, so mm-hmm. we can use this more forensically.
So, unfortunately, I didn't put a color bar, but in this plot, I color code at the, so the colored ridges that I overplot, they correspond to a color bar that goes from zero fraction of total stars there at white to all of them at this action bin is basically resonant in dark blue. And from this, I deduced that in the ridge, in the OLR ridge, because it's dark red here, that like in the ridge at least, all stars appear to be in resonance.
Have you done a simulation to see how quickly it turns on?
So I've played around with turning it on or not, but the nice thing, so in the models that I'm showing here, I'm just switching it on immediately, because the quasi-isothermal distribution function, it really makes the disk already in nice equilibrium with the potential. And so really the effect of the resonance is only, of the bar is really only at the resonance. So I think in this case, it doesn't matter if I turn it on or not. That just makes the signature a little bit weaker.
So maybe this is related to the earlier questions, but how do you go beyond axisymmetric actions, and could those explain some of these higher order features?
Yes. So there are people that work on this higher order things. And really the path that I wanted to go is, okay, sorry, I saw it differently. So if we want to do perturbation theory modeling, we have to assume a certain bar model. For the axisymmetric action and angles, we don't need to assume a bar model. We just have to believe that at least the axisymmetric potential is good enough. So I want to use this not as a bug, but actually as a feature, and learn if this can be used to learn something about the bar. And then only if we have learned something about the bar, we could do a proper perturbation theory modeling. But I think we're not that far yet.
Talk about that in my
research. Okay, very good.
Hi, so lovely talk. Am I right in thinking then that Jason's bar model is consistent with Ortwin's bar model? And I mean, if so, if you're putting the OLR in the region where the hat is, do we understand why the Hercules feature is so strong?
I would love to be able to answer this question, but no, I have no idea why the 1-4 resonance of the bar should cause such a strong red-blue feature, while the OLR a relatively weaker one. I don't see this in my mock data simulation. We don't see this in Francesca Fragudi's n-body simulations. I think Jason will probably also tell us something about the effect of the spiral arm. So maybe it's the spiral arm that messes things up there.
Thank you.
I'm just following Larry's question, but quite naive one. Well, I agree with that, that all these actions are kind of feature to trace these non-axiomatic potentials. But is that true that these are not anymore the integral of motion? I mean, all these actions change with time. So you should see the variations in your simulations.
Yes.
And then how do you select the time to show the features to compare with observation?
I do have plots about this somewhere, I thought. No, I actually removed it. So, no, sorry, I don't have the plot here. So the way how stars, so really the actions change over time for the stars, but they change in a quite predictable way. So they all oscillate a little bit, but if they're not at the resonance, just a little bit, really. And at the resonances, they oscillate more or less following the slopes of L over M. So again, yeah, they're not conserved, but the way how they're not conserved could be included in models. Sorry, I'm not sure if this answers your question fully. And about how I decided to use which time I'm going to show, I checked different integration times. And first, there's really a certain time when the orbits get more elongated to the bar. And because of the scattering, the ridge also looks stronger. And then for a longer time, so for example, for an integration time of 8 giga years, the ridge gets a little weaker because the stars really start oscillating around the resonance line. But I still see a ridge because of this initial moving over there. I could do that, but basically this ridge, they didn't change that much with time. They got a little weaker or a little stronger, but they always stayed at the same location. And in this qualitative state, this averaging over time, I think, is not necessary yet.
I wanted to say we probably wait till what James says tomorrow. But if you had only a two-dimensional disk, you could easily work out resonant actions if you concentrate on each resonance at a time.
But you need to know which resonance it is.
But just consider several. But the perturbation of the bar is probably not so uncertain now. At least you could make a reasonable model. I mean, it's 2, 4, and and then it's only the resonant angle combination that is the problem that can be dealt with, and then the others sort of perturb it. But then this would give you the families for each resonance in the bar potential. And of course, if we also have spiral arms, you would be back to the same problem that relative to the bar, the spiral arm perturbation would give you a time dependent effect. And then again, we would have to see what we can do with that.
Yeah.
Maybe the spiral arm perturbations aren't so large, so perhaps it's not as uncertain as it is now. But it's hard to see how you can get everything done in one model.
So basically what I'm struggling with here is that I couldn't find one model that can be clearly ruled out. And also the angles and the actions told me different things. And here looking at Jason's model again, while the angles could look quite nice, at the OLR we definitely don't have a red-blue feature. I guess spiral arms mess things up. I think that's basically the view that I have right now. But
okay, so. I think looks like everybody's ready for coffee. We'll meet again at 11.